closer.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Pre-Accident Podcast. I'm Todd Conklin, your wonderful host for today. Oh, my goodness, it's going to be a big day. Big day, big day, big day. So the reason I'm excited about today is, well, first of all, it's been a crazy week, but I think I probably say that every week, but I really meant it this week. So lots of stuff going on, and all of it pretty darn good, and all of it pretty darn exciting. I don't know about you guys, but this whole new view, this Safety 2, is really catching air. And companies and individuals and workers are becoming very interested. And what I think is even more important is really smart about this stuff. And that is amazing. It only makes our job easier. It's not a threat. It's not competition. It's just a way that we can slowly and surely, systematically, and actually think quite positively, change the world. And that's what we do. That's why we do it. And that's a fun part of doing it. I'm certain of that. Everything's groovy here, getting ready for the big trips, all these trips, the whole family on a cruise to, I don't know, someplace in the Caribbean, which will be fun because there's not really bad places to go there. And then right on the heels of that, baby, a European river cruise. So I'm going to get a lot of time at the buffet table during the month of June, which I'm very excited about, and you should be too. So now to today's podcast. Well, what can I say? It's a big one. It's long, and it's interesting, and I think you're going to like it. It features a guy named Mark Yeston, and Mark is currently chief ranger at the Black Canyon of the Gunnison National Park Service. Where he came from is a river ranger, district ranger for the Grand Canyon, and Mark is an authority. He's a humble man, and you'll hear it in his voice. But he's an authority on swiftwater rescue. He's an authority on wilderness medicine. He's authority on high-risk operations. He's huge on climbing, high-angle rescue. I mean, he does all that kind of stuff. But he does it not just just locally. He really represents a lot. And he's connected with a group of people that are just amazing. And I really wanted to talk to Mark because his notion of high reliability is the leadership notion. So he's like the field supervisor level of a highly reliable team. And he will give you a snapshot that is quite amazing. So without a lot of more discussion on this, I think I'm going to jump right into the podcast and let you listen. See what you think about what Mark has to say. So this is Mark Yeston on the Pre-Accident Podcast.
3, 2, 1, 4, 5.
Nice. Sounds good. Okay. So what were you saying? I interrupted you. Sorry.
You did. So, but that's okay. So one of the, a couple of the challenges. If we only interact with the people after something has gone wrong, then it's always seen as a problem. It's always seen that people are predisposed to think they're here to punish, they're here to embarrass, they're here to pull out the manual, see where we went wrong, and, you know, check off that box. So by being there when things are going right, and by making an after-action evaluation the norm,
right,
then it's no big deal when you show up when things go wrong because they expect you there in the first place.
Because you're there when things go right.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
One of the most difficult things is when something has gone wrong and some of your best people, they will be the first ones to kick down your door to come in and tell you exactly what they did wrong.
Well, of course, yeah.
And how they will make sure that it never happens again.
Right.
And if you stop there, it's great. It's easy because you can tell them, you're great. I'll give you a pass. You can go to your bosses and say, they totally admitted what they did wrong.
They're contrite. They'll never do it again.
They'll never
lesson
do it again.
Lesson was learned.
And they'll even write it up and communicate it to everybody else so that it never happens again. But I think that that's a starting point.
Yeah.
It's
well, I think if you stop there, you stop too early. But the question I'd ask you, and this is a really interesting question to me, is why do you think they do that?
In my experience, it's because they care very much about what they do, and they come in and do it right over and over and over again, and There are people who are empowered to feel responsible and empowered to use creativity. And when it doesn't go right, they see it as, I messed that up.
Right.
And I need to own it. I need to own it because that's my responsibility.
Okay. That's a good way to look at it.
So I think what I learned to do, thanks to you and others and thinking about this stuff is that, when that high performer, and I've been fortunate enough that I've almost worked exclusively with high performers.
Yeah, wouldn't you say in your world, everybody's really, really good? Like the bad people are still super good?
Yeah.
I
kind of joke about it, but not seriously. I think if you have a handful of friends in your life who are, rescue rangers, national park rangers, backcountry rangers, you don't need to keep your membership to AAA. Because these are people who are going to come out of bed at any hour into the worst conditions and solve your problem, even if they don't know you.
So, how funny, really?
Yeah. They're just great folks. And so that's why when they come to you, hat in hand and say, boy, I really balled this up, I say, thank you very much. But then the next question is, I said, I accept the fact that, you think that's the case, but my question is that I accept the fact that you think that you're responsible for this, but what I really want to know is when you were doing the thing that you were doing,
right,
it all made sense.
Right.
And that I have no question or reservation that you weren't trying to do the better than best thing.
Right.
So I'm not so much interested in what broke or went wrong or what decision you think you made poorly. I want to know why at that moment or in that progression, not even a moment, did everything make sense to you? Because that's where we're all going to figure out how to do things better.
Do you guys manage risk? Who are you? Let's start there. Introduce yourself. That would be good.
Oh, we're late.
Forgot, sort of.
That's all right. My name is Mark Yeston. And I've spent my whole life as a ski patroller, a river guide, and then later as a park ranger, because if you're a ski patroller and river guide and you don't have a trust fund,
that's all that's left.
Exactly.
Yeah. They're the only people that'll take you, really.
Which was the best thing that ever happened to me, because then I got to meet other park rangers, and I've worked in some of the most amazing places, Arches and Canyonlands National Park. I spent the bulk of my career at Grand Canyon National Park, and now I work at some smaller parks in Colorado.
What do you know about high reliability? What do you know about the new view? Maybe that's a better question.
I learned about the new view, as a ranger, as a paramedic, as a law enforcement officer, as a firefighter. You always hear about risk management. You're always thinking about risk management. You realize there are consequences and stuff like that. And then you go into an organization. And organizations are big, and organizations have people that they're responsible to. In my case, the taxpayers and the visitors to national parks and politicians, people who have oversight over us. And you need to report up to them in terms that make sense, numbers,
Right.
How many people got hurt? How many people didn't, either visitors to the parks or national park rangers or staff members, how many got hurt? How severe was it? How much time was lost from work? How much did this cost? Those are all measurable things. And so when I first came in, I realized this is a responsibility, to track these things and then try to drive all of those numbers down to zero. Wouldn't it be great if nobody ever got hurt in a national park? Wouldn't it be great if no employee ever, got injured, in trying to help other people? Zero is a great goal. And
it's complex math. I mean, the math is hard.
But I think I was predisposed to be a little bit distrustful of the way we count things, because very early in my career, before I was a park ranger, I was a volunteer trail crew member for a different land management agency. And the volunteer group the year before us had a horrible, incident rate. Busted thumbs and hatchets and saws and, all of those kind of things. Sunburn, reportable injuries. The next year when I was there, the crew leaders made a determination that we get in trouble when we report these things, so let's not report them unless they're serious. And so that particular work unit went from being one of the worst to one of the best. And when we showed up at the end of the season to get our safety awards, wearing slings and eye patches. They gave us very sharp folding buck knives with the agency logo on it. Said, good job. And then, of course, we proceeded to start to cut each other. So, you know, accidentally. So from early on, I thought, well, I understand why this counting is important. But as I progressed and worked with these people who are just care so much about what they do, I realized that it didn't serve them very well, even though it was an important administrative requirement. It didn't serve them very well. So instead of coming to a group of people and saying, we've had three incidents and we need to make that zero or as close to zero as we can, I thought, you know, we can probably do a better job of learning what's causing these things. And the people who are involved in these incidents have a wealth of information. And if they live in an environment where they think reporting these things is going to lead to trouble.
Yeah, then why report?
Then why report?
Yeah.
And so I, and not just me, and many others that I work with, and helped out by you, you know, a decade ago when you first came and started to talk to us about this stuff, we decided, you know, yes, we'll meet all the administrative reporting requirements, and those have their utility. But what we're really interested in here is catching ourselves when we're doing things right and catching ourselves when we're doing things wrong and making talking about planning, you know, to the extent possible and learning from every single incident. Because no matter how, and I hate the word routine, because no matter how routine something is, there's always something different. You know, we tried to build boxes around parameters around what we're going to do. Like, we're not going to fly a helicopter if the wind is, you know,
the crazy thing for you is that your routine. I mean, describe your plant floor.
The what?
Your plant floor. What does your production area look like? What is your?
What's
line three look like in your factory?
Well, you know, we had a. DuPont Company had a really nice, like, I don't know, kind of a management by walking around thing that we kind of used for a while, and I thought this is probably a great thing to do in an engineered environment. You know, the floors have been engineered to be level, the lighting has been engineered to be of the proper brightness. You know, there are shields in place and things like that, and it got me to thinking. I was like, you know, man, you know, where I was working then was the Grand Canyon. You know, I can't tell you which Grand Canyon, but the Grand Canyon.
A Grand Canyon. It's a canyon that is grand.
And I thought, well, you know, our shop floor is 277 miles long, a mile deep, 18 miles across. At the bottom of it, where it should be flat, there's a whitewater river. In the winter, there's 8 feet of snow up top. In the summer, it's 130 degrees. And there are sometimes wild and rabid animals and people. So I thought, this is not an engineered environment. This is not a manageable shop floor.
Is managing risk as a chief ranger different than it was as a river ranger? Or as a working ranger, as a somebody that hikes around and wears a Smokey the Bear hat? Sorry, you don't say Smokey the Bear in your agency. A flat cap.
You know,
I believe you call it a flat
cap. I think the other agency, you know, and we love them, have changed it to Smokey Bear. We still say Smokey the Bear, Todd, because that's what we all grew up with.
Yeah, no, I'll never change it. I'll never make that change.
That's like messing with the Trix Bunny.
I agree. Trix the Bunny.
The Bunny, yeah. Who the heck would do that? So is it different? I think the first thing that would occur to me is, oh, it's a matter of scale. As an individual trying to manage risk, you know, in a you know, wake up in the morning and there's been a flash flood and the river's come up 3,000 CFS and there are, you know, trees floating down it and you've got to run some big whitewater, that would be very individualized. And so I think my first answer, which I think would actually be wrong, is that as you move into, you know, middle management supervision, that it's just an increase in complexity or just span of control. But I don't think that's the case.
I would totally push you on that, I think.
What I really think, and please do correct me because I want to learn.
I don't know
stuff.
If I'd correct you, but I just would push you.
What I really think is that, you know, we talk about the pointy end of the stick, the blunt end of the stick, and I like to think of it more as a hollow needle, but the problem with needles, they don't bend. And the important part of this stick analogy is that the learning, the innovation, the adaptation of conscientious people trying to go home safe at the end of the day and provide a good service or product to people, that's the sharp end. The blunt end that's fixed to the trunk of the tree is by definition pretty rigid. You know,
right.
It's that middle part of the stick, you know, the managers in an agency or an organization that need to be adherent to the reporting requirements and the, you know,
right.
information
Fair
that
enough.
The overhead needs. But they need to be that bendy point of the stick so that they are continuously open and learning and, aggressively going to the people at the pointy end and saying, how are we doing when it's right? What did we learn from this? How are we going to do better the next time when we got it wrong? And like I said, being present when things go right makes being present when things go wrong seamless.
I actually think that's a brilliant idea. I mean, I think people can really learn from that, that if you're present when things go right, it almost allows you to be there when things don't go wrong. If you're not there when things go right, you almost don't have a right, put quotes around
right.
that, but a right to be there when things go wrong. So when you come in and do the investigation after something breaks, shame on you if you weren't there the many times or some of the many times when things didn't break and they did the same operation.
And, you know, I was kind of naive, and it was a big eye opener for me because I kind of came from, you know, when I was a ski patroller, we would do avalanche mitigation and stuff, and we would brief ahead of time about what we were going to do. And then we would come back because, you know, every patroller was going to have a unique perspective on what happened that day and how responsive things were to the explosives or the other techniques that we used. And then we would come together, use that information, share it so that we could inform, you know, the next day. We
right.
just have more information. And
so really planning for the next day started with the after action of the day prior.
Right, and we didn't even call it that. That was just organic and normal. And
right.
I can't imagine another way of doing business. But, you know, when I started working into being a supervisory park ranger, and I worked at, you know, a few different parks, and I was just, I had a real eye-opener at one park in particular where we had like a, you know, a law enforcement episode. People were, you know, reported as, you know, having rifles and being threatening, and it turned out to be BB guns, thank goodness, you know. But, you know, my group of folks that I work with, you know, went out there and handled it well, and I was the boss of that particular group at the time. And so when we all reassembled at the trailhead to, you know, I said, hey, let's talk about, you know, how this went. And they looked at me with horror because they had never... The only time the boss would ever show up and want to know things is if something went wrong.
Yeah, right.
And to me, that told me that you need to be there when it's right. Well, you basically need to be there all the time.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And there's no better excuse to walk out of a meeting than, hey, the helicopter's landing. I've got to go check in with everybody.
Oh, no, wait a minute. If you're telling me I can actually use this to get out of a meeting, I'm in.
Absolutely.
I'm committed.
You need a helicopter and a dispatch center and a big river, but you can do it. I mean...
So you're going to deny this, because I know you will, because you always do. I think you probably worked in the highest reliability organization I've ever seen. Certainly better than the military. Certainly much more reliable than flight deck operations on an aircraft carrier. And that would be the search and rescue function you guys did at this canyon you speak of, this Grand Canyon. Why?
In two words, I would say the influence of one person, and that's a guy named Ken Phillips, who
okay.
right now is in charge of search and rescue for the National Park Service, and he came up as a ranger, pretty much spent his whole career, you know, at Grand Canyon, and just a guy with a passion for learning and a passion for keeping people safe and serving the public and taking care of people.
So what did he do? Because that's remarkable.
I'll tell you what he did. Well, I inherited some. I mean, when I came into that operation, you know, his ideas had been at work. And it really, it's not his ideas exclusively, but importantly, he was a student of other organizations. And when we had big, you know, catastrophes in the wildland fire world, and you know, he would look at, you know, I want to be a high reliability organization. How do we do this? And he also had access to a laminating machine, which we've teased him relentlessly about, you know. So every single person got a laminated card, and the 250 to 400 times a year that we would get engaged in some sort of major search and rescue.
Okay, so say that again. 250 to 400 times a year.
And I think a few years were, you know, busted 400, maybe approached 500.
So you went into high-risk emergent operations over 400 times a year often.
Yeah. Well, you know, I would call, again, I hate.
How important do you think is the fact that you got to practice being reliable? You do it that many times, you actually get to practice it.
Yeah, but that's scary, Todd, because, you know, one of the things that always kept me awake and still does, you know, when dealing with this is, you know, when things have gone well, perfectly, yeah. We're backslapping, we're feeling good about it, we're looking at it, you know, you still have to ask yourself, you know, maybe we've been lucky the past 785 times.
How do you determine the difference between a really good program and luck?
I think a really good program is unsettled in sitting on the foundation of success. I think a really good program is constantly questioning just that. Did we get lucky? Are we lucky? Or, you know, are we really doing this the right way?
Which is why I said, I'm going to say this and you're going to disagree. The crazy thing, and I think it's a really good thing, is that you guys are the probably the highest reliability organization in the world. One of them, for sure. And you don't know that. Because
if you
believed your own press, then you wouldn't be highly reliable.
Well, Todd, I don't think it's scalable. You know, so if you compare us to the military or something else like that, I don't know if you could scale up. I mean, perhaps somebody way smarter than any of us could. You know, so I think it's apples and oranges.
I'm convinced
organizations
aren't reliable. I'm convinced that teams of performers who work together in order to perform functions, they create reliability. They also create safety. They create quality. They create all that stuff.
Yes.
We talk about safety in big agencies in the federal government as a discrete column on a form, right? I mean, we talk about it.
Yes.
And it's very different in a boardroom. There's a guy who's in charge of safety. There's a guy who's in charge of quality. There's a guy who's in charge of operations. And they all make a lot of money and sit in different chairs.
Mm-hmm.
The one place that separation doesn't exist is the ranger on the trail in the canyon. There's no separation between safety.
Or on any trail or any canyon.
Well, yeah,
or any mountain,
any place.
Or swamp.
Yeah, any place. You can pick any place.
Yeah.
That separation is entirely artificial, and it's a structural component of an organization. So organizations, I think, as a whole, do what organizations need to do to create value. That's what they do. That's why they exist.
Well, and Todd, I think you're right. I mean, safety can be a tired term. It can be a slogan. You know, it can be the.
Oh, I think it totally is.
The writing on the doormat: safety begins here. I'm like, well, that means the rest of the world is where it ends. That's bad. I don't like seeing that. Yeah. You know, I don't. You have to use the word safety, and we all want to be safe, and we want, you know, the people that we're taking care of and helping to be safe. But I think if I understand what you were saying there, I would completely agree. I would agree that performance of a team or a group or a management structure is not necessarily driven by safety. We want to, you know, have safety, you know, but we don't go to work just to be safe. We go to work to solve problems.
I bet you when you do a low haul, so when you go to rescue somebody off a ledge, in your mind, short haul, right? You do a short haul. In your mind, there is no difference between the rescue and safe operations.
Oh no!
There's no there. That's
I
how
would
you
say
do the
that
work.
I would say that the operation is a tightly wound cable of safety planning, thoughtfulness, at, you know, review and adherence to what our parameters and our boxes, risk benefit, and also the judgment and the experience and the training that all of the people involved in that have received.
Yeah.
Because I can't tell people, you're going to get down there and find this thing and do step A, B, C, and D. Checklists are great, and they're absolutely essential for certain functions.
Right.
But when you're going out into the world of, you know, we have a blinking red dot on a map, somebody has pressed a distress button, we have no idea what it is. You're relying on training, judgment.
And you do that 400 times a year.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Have you thought about it?
I think...
I mean, you live it and stuff. I get that, but...
It's significant. And I think now that I'm not doing that every day, I think of it more, and I think, my gosh, you know, that's... That's pretty amazing. That's why, you know, these are the people that I respect most in the whole world.
What keeps those people safe? If you had to pick some stuff out of your palette, palette from which you paint, there are many colors on the palette from which you paint.
I think a bit of paranoia.
Yes.
I think a constant level of discomfort and being a bit unsettled.
So let's pull the string on that one, because that healthy sense of unease, right, that tiny bit of, and get a little paranoia is a good thing.
Right.
Someone with no paranoia probably is a sociopath or somewhere in that category. I mean, maybe. Right? I mean,
I don't know many.
Yeah, well, because most people have, they got a little bit of paranoia. They're concerned, right? They're aware. So that notion of being aware, of being mindful, that's a word they use a lot.
Mm-hmm.
How do you build that into a culture? How do you build that into an operation?
I think going back to, I think when you walk in day one on that job or job similar, you've already kind of proven yourself in other areas. You know, so I don't want to say that these are elite people, because, you know, they're certainly not, and they would never claim to be. But they have talents and backgrounds, and I think most importantly, they have a kind of, look, no one is egoless.
Right.
But you can discern in people a sense that they are in it for the mission, and they are in it for the support of the team, and they are not in it for their own personal, you know, well, maybe personal gratification, because there's plenty of gratification.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, and heartbreak. I mean, because things don't always go exactly as we hope. But people who are there to do the right job, and they're so dang hard on themselves, Todd. As we said before, when things go wrong, they will knock your door down to tell you how they messed up. And
so do you spend a lot of time as a supervisor then apologizing? I know it feels that way. I'm sorry that happened. If we stop there, we've stopped too early. Tell us more, tell us more, tell us more.
I hope not to be in that position, because I hope as a supervisor and manager that wouldn't be necessary, that they would not expect to hear that from me, because we already have a relationship that's different than that.
And that goes back to that I'm present when there's success, and so that I can also be present when the success isn't as successful.
Yes.
He says, trying to create a way to say things screw up, but not the word screw up.
Yeah, you can say it.
I can? Okay,
yeah.
Good, thank God. Yeah. That was touch and go.
I mean, a kid would have to dig pretty deep into Apple iTunes to find.
Okay, then I'm probably good. But I mean, I think that's really interesting. It's, I don't know, it's what you guys do is really remarkable. And it's really, the crazy thing is it's not so much that the organization doesn't support you or not support you. Equipment is available, not available. All those things are really normal. Sometimes you have the right equipment. Sometimes they can't buy it for you. It's really more of an operating philosophy that's really created a system that doesn't manage failure. It manages the margins of failure.
Well,
does that make sense?
I just thought of this as you were saying that, because I was trying to think. I think, Todd, a questioning organization, and I don't know how you invent that except just to live it and make it happen. A questioning organization means that the most junior person, the most senior person are on equal footing when it comes to questioning what we're about to do or asking questions about what we just did. And I'll give you a great example.
Yeah, do.
And what popped into my head while you were saying that, I was remembering that, you know, believe it or not, snows a lot at the Grand Canyon. I've worked in a lot of places where there's lots of snow, but Grand Canyon is one of the most slippery places in the world that I've ever been, you know, and because it snows on a warm ground and then it freezes into, you know, it's almost like following a Zamboni around. And so if you ever ask me, like, what kinds of injuries do these high risk, you know, these crazy rescue rangers who dangle on dental floss out of the door of helicopters and things like that, they trip, slip, and fall like people, like their, you know, their compatriots in supermarkets or warehouses. That's what hurts us, you know? And so I remember in a particularly brutal winter, you know, our safety office, you know, staffed with good people, said, hey, you know, people are slipping and tripping and falling. We're going to make an investment. We're going to give everybody, you know, these traction cleats. I don't want to use any brand names because, frankly, they're good. But, you know, And they work great. You could put these spikes on your boots, and
right.
when you were walking on the ice, they were fantastic. The minute you came into the fire station on the concrete floor, it was basically like having malfunctioning roller skates on. And so what we did was we transferred people falling down on the ice. We took care of that problem by putting the spikes on their feet, but as soon as they came indoors, you know, they started slipping all over the place. And then we said, well, they need to put benches by the door so that people can take these things on and off.
Absolutely.
So, and then it became the rule. Like, you must take this on or take this off. You must put this on. Well, now you're taking these things on, off 10 or 15 times a day. And, you know, they're rubberized and they're like a stretched rubber band. And so all of a sudden we start getting injuries where people are basically shooting these things into each other's faces as they're taking them on and off in the doorways. So they didn't make it so much of a rule as an option that you had this tool to use. And I think people were smart enough to use them when they needed them and knew when to take them on and off. And then came the Walk Like a Penguin campaign.
Yeah, we did that too. Isn't that the goofiest thing ever?
Walk Like a Penguin. I mean, it was on Good Morning America.
You know, they fall all the time, penguins.
Well, that was the thing. And this is where I'm getting back to the questioning culture. So when the you know, Walk Like a Penguin, I mean, not only are they smartly dressed, but they really know how to walk around on the ice. You know, Walk Like a Penguin. And I remember a couple days after that came out, I walked into, you know, the ranger office there, and I saw one of the other rangers gold penguins falling down. And sure enough, there are just page after page of video of absolutely adorable penguins walking in a, you know, line, and then one of them falls over, and the rest of them look at it like, meh, you know.
Idiot.
So
he's a bad penguin.
Right. So, you know, ice is slippery, and people fall down. And we talked about this when, you know, rangers would, you know, be in the bottom of the Grand Canyon, and, you know, it's by definition, it's the place is falling apart. It's eroding. And so there's loose rock, there's solid rock, but every once in a while you just step on a loose rock, and you trip and fall. And, you know, we finally ended up asking ourselves, like, we had to accept the fact that people are going to fall, even if they're paying attention, even if they're using hiking poles, even if they have the right shoes and stuff like that. So is there anything we can do to help them land better? And because, you know, they're mostly athletic people who
have to go
through all kinds of physical training and defensive tactics and stuff like that, we could incorporate some of, like, here's how to land. And I think that might have helped a little bit.
It's a good idea.
I remember being in a root cause analysis for one of the rangers who, you know, stepped on a loose rock and tripped over. And, you know, root cause analysis was, I think it's, boy, I would sure, if I owned a rocket ship and something went wrong, I want root cause analysis
me
there
too.
To figure out, right, you know, if my cat gets sick, I don't want root cause analysis because they're going to hand me like a plastic bag full of bones and red fluid and say, here's the problem. You know, it doesn't do me any good.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? But I remember, you know, in there with the ranger and his boots and the whole team of, you know, very earnest root cause analysis people and a flip chart and sticky notes and going through, you know, where the, you know, can we inspect the tread on the boots and, you know, was the ranger paying attention? And then the facilitator, you know, took one step backwards to put the sticky note on the flip chart and tripped over it. It was rolling around on the floor, you know, surrounded by sticky paper and immediately surrounded by like eight earnest, you know, paramedic rangers who wanted to help. And we finally realized that, you know, sometimes people are just going to fall over.
You didn't do a root cause analysis on the facilitator falling.
We ran out of time, thankfully.
Or post-it notes.
Yeah, exactly.
We're stopped because we're out of post-it notes.
They're terribly dangerous.
You've learned as much as the post-it note will allow
right.
you to learn.
Exhausted
now you must
supply.
Stop.
That's right.
You must stop.
It's better for everyone.
What do you think? What do you think the future is? What interests you now?
I think that it's been interesting to see how other organizations that we would think are very different from what we do are starting to think about these things in a different way, and that it's energizing, you know. And so when I talk to a forklift operator or I talk to somebody else who has maybe spent an entire career keeping their nose down and hoping that they don't dent anything because the bosses are going to fly down from upstairs, open up to page 64 of the Don't Bump Into Things manual
right.
and show me what I did wrong.
And if it's the third time, they probably lose their job.
I know. And losing your job's a big deal.
Yeah.
But I think I'm comforted to know that, you know, I go out and I talk to different groups and organizations and stuff like that, and I teach, you know, I teach volunteer, you know.
Well, you teach a lot of stuff, don't you? What do you teach? Can you say?
You know, I teach wilderness medicine. Some wilderness risk management. You know.
Well, you work a lot with doctors, right? Who do that?
I wouldn't say a lot. You know, I do an annual course, volunteer kind of thing, where I teach medical professionals, not necessarily medicine, but how to take what they know and use it in an austere environment or someplace
yeah.
where they don't have, you know, all the nurse and you know, astronauts show up for that class. Apparently, they have a good training budget at NASA. You know,
You have astronauts?
You want to be intimidated. You know, it's like, oh, I'm
I believe that's called a humble brag. I think that's what that's called, is a humble brag.
Oh, no, they you know, look at you strange the whole time.
They don't think
actually, they're great. They're very cool. But no, getting back to what you were saying, Todd, I am intrigued and I'm comforted by thinking that whatever you call it, the new view, the
safety two. Yeah, there's a lot of names
two,
for it. A lot of names,
you know, and I don't think that it's that new. I think that it's starting to gain some traction, and I think that, and I'm comforted to see, like, you know, in the government, we can do whatever we think is right and see if it works or not, but we're not really measured against, you know, did you produce results. And I know that when this stuff is going on in, you know, big corporations, and they're seeing a bottom line financial benefit to it, and they're deciding we need to expand this kind of thinking throughout our entire team from the, you know, day one hire to our senior management,
right?
That's encouraging. I think that helps the world. And I don't think it just helps the world for safety. I think it helps the world for how to manage people, how to lead people, and how to be a humble leader and care about your people and care about what their experience is.
How important is leadership? I mean, you've talked about it since we turned the thing on.
I think it's a tired term, just like safety. You know, it's like
a little bit.
You know,
leadership, I agree.
This, leadership that, you know. And
but if your leader, so Decker calls this kind of safety differently.
Uh-huh.
And none of these are sticking, but they're all kind of saying the same thing. And I'd listen to you say it's not new, and I agree with you, I think. What's crazy is that lots and lots of people don't think this way. When a ranger falls, they think if the ranger were more careful, he or she would not have fallen. Therefore, the problem is we need to ask our rangers to care more.
And even the ranger...
Yeah, and
or the person, as I said earlier, is they're going to be the first person to tell you, I should have been
more careful,
you know, doing this.
Yeah,
that,
I should have been more
whatever
careful.
Differently.
Yeah, and so you get into the situation where, and this is what a lot of people that listen to this think about, is it's okay, these ideas are really helpful, but they're only helpful if I can get these ideas to the top of the organization so that when I come in and say, we got to fix X instead of punishing Joe, they're understanding enough to realize that this is the same outcome. The world gets better and more reliable, but a much different way to fix that problem.
Everybody wants to go home and sleep well. Everybody wants to feel like no matter what chaos happened during the day, by the time we lay our head down on the pillow, order has been restored. And one of the easiest ways to do that is, and I don't think the best way, but the easiest way to do that is to say, like, we identified the problem, we identified the mistake, we will now go back to page 63 of the manual, you know, put a red dot over the decision-making matrix and train everybody that this will never happen again. And people go to bed thinking, like, well, thank goodness that was taken care of. But it doesn't work that way.
No, not at all.
You're going to have to lose a few nights' sleep.
Can you scare your guys into being safer?
No.
They're not very scared of stuff, are they?
No. I think you want to be skeptical. You want to be, I don't want to use the word paranoid. You want to be, I think, what did you say?
Mindful.
Mindful.
We call it
call it productively nervous.
Yeah. You know, a healthy sense of unease, right?
Yeah, healthy
or,
sense of unease.
Or a questioning attitude. I mean, there's lots of ways to talk about this.
But I don't want to confuse that with, like, you know, I want you to be, you know, situationally aware, which is great. I would love it if I was situationally aware enough, or the pilot flying my aircraft, or the person, you know, balance or making sure that my, you know, checking account is,
I was going to say banking.
Yeah, exactly. Is situationally aware enough to pay attention to, you know, 360 degrees worth of things, but you can't.
Right. I mean, the situational aware is a really elaborate way to say the worker was bad. The worker was momentarily
when I hear,
incompetent.
And I've had people come to me and said, I had a loss of situational awareness and I won't receive that from them.
What do you say?
I say, picture a wheel with 360 spokes on it, and they are in the back of your head and the side of your head. They're all around you, and you have no idea which one is going to come poking out at you. But the 10 most dangerous ones you tried to put in the front of your vision, and you are paying close serial attention to those things, and then the one nicks you in the back of the head, that's not a loss of situational awareness. That's the fact that you are existing in an area of complexity that even a supercomputer, even a bank of supercomputers, could not compute all of the the exigencies and possibilities.
And you're exactly right.
Yeah.
I like to say when people say there's a loss of situational awareness, I look at them kind of quizzically and say, where'd it go?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Because if they lost it, did they find it
again?
We
have a special pocket in our flight suits.
Where did it go?
Yeah.
I think your answer is way better, but it's a very elaborate mechanism, but they use it a lot. The maritime industry, they talk about it all the time because it's a very elaborate way to say, we need you to pay attention to what could possibly fail before it fails and do something about it. Stop work, fix it, call in the cavalry, whatever you need to do.
Yeah.
It's really retrospective, but this is difficult and a little controversial.
We talk about things like, head on a swivel and all those things. You know, the idea is that you're just, trying to take in as many data points as you possibly can in an evolving situation so that you can make a good choice. You know, but the fact of the matter is, if you tell somebody, pay close attention to these, one, two, or three things, they will probably do a pretty darn good job of paying attention to those one, two, or three things. But what's going to get them is item number seven that's coming in an unexpected way.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So what do you do to facilitate this this different view? How do you define safety? Sorry, that's a hard question, I know.
Yeah.
It's really hard to define. It's
depends on who I'm talking
to. It's a very esoteric term, really.
Yeah. If I'm talking to people that I'm reporting to, and I could honestly say, safety is the absence of incidents, because I need to report, we had two of these last year, and this year we're doing great. We only had one.
Yeah, zero or near zero.
Yeah, and I get that. I understand. If I'm talking to my to the folks I work with, I like to say I work for the people I supervise, because if everything's going well, I've got all the time in the world to work for them. And so what I tell them is that, safety is something that is created in the aftermath of basically doing your job well. And bringing the talents that you have, bringing the awareness that you have, and having the freedom to make decisions, recognizing that your superiors are placing you, your bosses are placing you in a situation where you cannot control the variables. Maybe they can't even control the variables. And certainly in a lot of the settings that we work in, the variables are in charge of, Mother Nature's in charge.
Doesn't that screw up personal accountability? What do you guys think about accountability? Because I can't even imagine a scenario where you could hold yourself more to account than you do now. But what do they say when they talk about accountability? We must hold these guys accountable.
Well, I've seen some very bad examples where,
there's a lot, yeah.
Yeah, where, next person who gets hurt, your account gets billed for, which again, drives away the safety or the reporting of incidents.
Did I tell you about the time I was teaching a class, and there's a whole bunch of people in the back of the room, and at one point, and I didn't know who they were, and at one point, one guy said, when does personal accountability click in? So, and you get that question all the time, so it's not, it's a good question, and it's really predictable, so I wasn't very surprised.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, give me some context. Help me understand. And he says, well, let's say the gorillas get out for the third time. Have I told you this? So I say, what? Because that's the same thing you would say.
What's wrong with the gate?
Yeah, you're right. And he says, we're from a major zoo, and we had three gorilla escapes last year.
Wait, Todd, can't we all say we come from a major zoo?
Yeah, we do. Okay. Yes, it's true. So they had three gorilla escapes in a year. And so I said, what'd you do? And he said, the third escape, I had to hold the gorilla keeper accountable. I terminated him. And I said, why did you terminate him? And then I paused and said, because near as I can tell, you probably fired the best urban gorilla catcher in the world, because three times last year. He got to get the gorillas
That's
back.
That's right.
He said, because I had to send a message to the rest of the organization that this behavior was inappropriate. So then I asked the next question, which is the very question you asked, what'd you fix? And he said, we fixed the gate.
Really?
Yeah, that's what he said. And I said, you can't fire the worker and fix the gate. Right? Something's really wrong with that.
Seems to be.
Right? That was a really hard moment for that guy. Actually, he was not very happy.
Yeah.
And he was French. So he was not very happy in kind of a French way.
We love the French.
No, yeah, I'm pro-France.
Oh, yeah.
Don't get me wrong. But,
oh, my gosh.
It was a very interesting sort of snapshot, a little view into this notion of accountability.
And it's like it's like if I hand you a glass with a hole in the for spilling. Huh, interesting.
Well, it's kind of, so you have really good people that work for you. So probably
work with me.
Right, or you work for them. I can even use your model. Probably the accountability question doesn't come up very much because you've said it a bunch of times. They punish themselves before you can even get to them.
Yeah, that's not an incentive.
What happens if you have a not so good person that somehow got moved in a big government agency?
Well,
sometimes we turf our trouble around.
I had it a lot easier before I was in the government. Nothing against the government. But when I was a ski patrol supervisor.
I know it's hard.
The team, the peers, would fire people with absolutely no authority. I mean, I'd show up at work in the morning and I'd see like a pile of skis and personal belongings laying out in the snow by the locker room and be like, whose stuff is that? They're like, oh, Bob, we had to let him go. I'm like, you can't let him go. I'm the boss here. Yeah. They say he wasn't working out and we told him never to come back and you'd never see him again. So that doesn't happen in my present work setting. I would say, thankfully, and, I mean, if you watch media reports and stuff like that, you may think that people who engage in this kind of work or work for the government are not conscientious or not whatever. In my experience, that's absolutely not the case. So it's rare to get a person who's not competent. It is even rarer. I would say it's more common to get somebody who has just risen to the point where they're not going to be much more successful beyond this point. They're lacking in some skill that you either may or may not be able to train them into, a people skill, a technical skill, or something like that.
Right.
And they've just reached their apogee.
I think they call that the Peter principle.
The Peter principle, right.
Yes.
Yeah. But more commonly, the people that I've worked with, the people who kind of get into this line of work, are pretty darn competent and capable, and I would say bendy. They're going to learn, and they're going to improve, and they're going to do a very good job. I haven't had...
Is there pressure from above to hold people to account?
It's interesting. There's a lot of accountability in government, as there should be. I mean, like, every American's paying their taxes.
I agree, yeah.
You don't want to have any waste or anything like that. So I'd say there's a lot of accountability. But I think it's a lot of accountability on things that are really easily measured. Like, what percentage of employees took this online training, or what percentage of employees, have done this or that. But in the world where we work, we're not really getting surveys about when the lightning was coming down and the rocks were falling and the wind was blowing 40 miles an hour, did the employee A, B, or C? So those things aren't really measured unless there's a catastrophe or a failure. Then everybody floods in from the overhead to find out, what the heck went wrong.
So when you guys do an investigation, is it an investigation that has... So why do you do investigations?
Why
formal investigations? Yeah, why?
I think the honest answer would be, on the one hand, like administrative accountability. I think if the investigation is done well and conscientiously, then at the end of the day, we don't just have a big, bloody red finger pointing at what went wrong. We have a whole bunch of things that we learned from that we're going to go out and communicate to everybody so that, that thing won't happen again, and maybe something similar won't happen again, and we can all benefit from it somehow.
Good.
Yeah.
I mean, that's good. The first part's scary, but the second part's really good.
Yeah.
The culpability part, I think, is kind of scary. And not very interesting, actually, because... who screwed up. It's a mystery.
Listen, every boss's job would be super easy if you just took the employee's word, if they come in the door and they say, hey, I messed this up, boss, I'll never do it again. And then you can report to your superiors, hey, he's sorry and he won't do it again. Let's all go to bed, at our own houses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that took a turn there. That got weird.
That went
creepy fast.
Yeah. Folks, the government doesn't live in the same house.
Okay, we're back.
Yes.
So if you could tell somebody who did high-risk work, anything, oil rig, truck driver, crane operator, forklift driver, you talked about them, if you could tell them the first thing to do to start turning that around, what would you give them? What advice would you give them?
Am I talking to the immediate supervisor or the manager or the
worker? You get to pick. You get to pick. I think you have to talk to all of them, but you can pick. You're in charge.
Well, and here, and I don't think that I can speak with full authority on this because I haven't done all of those other jobs, but I can say that as I learn more about this, as you know, over the years, that I think we're, you know, truck driver, you know, oil rig worker, high tension line workers, we have a lot more in common than we think. Bank regulator, auditor. I mean, we have a lot more in common than we think when it comes to confronting what we think we know and then finding something that we didn't expect. So to the worker, I would say, don't be too quick to blame yourself. You know, don't be too quick to accept responsibility. We all want to accept responsibility. One of the great things we have is like a free people, is you know, free will and responsibility for our actions. And I think sometimes we're too quick to assume responsibility. And if that's where we fold the tents, we don't learn anything. So I would say to the employee, don't just run into your boss and tell him, this is where I messed up and I will never do this again. Because at the very least, the other 10 people you work with aren't going to learn, you know, what it is you're not going to do the next time, right? And more importantly, you may not have messed up. You may have made like the absolute best choice for what was confronting you at the time with all of your experience, your training, your desire to, you know, advance, your desire to go home safely. You made a good choice. And so if you completely subvert that by running into your boss and saying, well, I blew this, boss, and here's how I won't do it again, I don't think that's good. To the supervisor,
yes,
the next level up, when the employee comes to you and says, I messed this thing up, or even if they come to you and say, like, hey, this thing happened, I don't know anything about it, we need to look at it as an opportunity to learn. Because I don't think, I mean, it would be a different podcast, it would be a different book, it would be a different everything if we were dealing with sociopaths and criminals in the workplace, people who intentionally come in and choose to do bad things.
Right.
They're rare.
Yeah,
they're
incredibly
out there.
So.
I mean, you know, gazillions of flight hours happen before somebody intentionally flies an airplane full of people on the side of a mountain. That is an outlier.
It's a total outlier. And what's even more interesting about that is I think saying he's the co-pilot of the German wings, saying he's a sociopath, which I don't think is accurate, saying he's severely mentally ill, which I do think is accurate, really is not very telling.
Yeah.
The better question is the system so fragile that one 27-year-old pilot with less than 600 hours on that piece of equipment, when left alone, could barricade himself into the cockpit and commit suicide.
Yeah, because these things are unfathomable.
Right.
But we, as the supervisor, you can't sit there and think, you can't accept the easy answer when the employee comes to you and tell you, I did this thing wrong. Or you can't assume that somebody showed up for work with the intent. I mean, that's an outlier. That's an egregious example of an outlier that we just talked about.
Right,
the German pilot.
Right.
But that's not our norm.
No, not
That's not even close to our norm. And so what we need to understand is that people show up to do well. I mean, they may not like their boss. They may not like their pay. They may not like whatever. But if you're showing up for work, you're probably showing up for work because you want to do a decent job and, you know, get by or maybe even excel, and you want to go home safely and enjoy the fruits of your labor.
You want to make friends, tell some jokes, screw
Absolutely.
Around a bit.
You love it.
If you get a chance to loaf, let's loaf a bit. Let's take a longer break.
I don't know what loaf is,
yeah,
Todd.
Well, I can explain it to you later.
Okay, please. Diagram it for
yes,
me.
Yes, I will.
But, you know, so to the supervisor, I'd say when that employee comes to you with the easy answer, it's incumbent on you to put that employee in a safe zone and say, I understand that you didn't wake up this morning to come here and have this thing happen. And that whatever you did or whatever was done by the group really made perfect sense, you know, and you thought, this is going to work out fine. And what I want to know is, like, how did you arrive at that position? And what can we learn from, you know?
From what happened.
From what happened.
So what do you tell the senior leadership? What's your advice to senior leaders? These are the guys with the good shoes and the fancy chair.
That's still government, so the shoes aren't that great.
Let's say you go to a company where they have Learjets and stuff.
Oh, yeah. I want to tell them that there's a difference. You know, not that I'm asked a lot, but I want to tell them. I mean, sometimes I get these guys on a long river trip and I can, you know. But I would tell them, I said, the ability for an agency, a corporation, an organization to report back to stakeholders, stockholders, taxpayers, whatever, metrics that people could understand, pie charts and graphs and things like that, is always going to be essential. It's never going to go away. But if we think that that is what's going to improve our organizations and make us better, then we're all wrong. And so we can report all that stuff up, and they should report all that stuff up, but they need to look down into the organization, support their supervisors, support their managers, and realize just that basic thing at the worker level. People show up to do a decent job for the most part. People don't show up to get hurt. People don't show up to harm others.
Yeah.
You know? And when those things happen, there's a whole book, there's a whole story to learn. And give us the room. Give us the patience to tell the story. You may have, you know, political and administrative immediacies. That's never going to go away. You may have media pressure for, you know, we want an answer. We want to know what went wrong. We want to restore, you know, the viewing public back to a sense of safety that, you know, everything's back in order and we're going to address this. And don't you worry, we've got a procedure. And when we find out how this went wrong, there's going to be, you know, hell to pay. That's all fine. But if we really want to progress, we need to be open-minded to, you know, how work actually happens.
Did we get it all? Huh? Did we miss anything? What do you think? That's a pretty good hour.
Was that an hour?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it went pretty
fast. Is this on? Are you taping?
No, I didn't tape. None of this is being
Thank goodness.
Saved.
I'll certainly be fired.
Yes, I'm looking for a new job. Did we get everything?
I think so.
I think we had a pretty good time. What do you think?
Surprisingly, yes.
Would you do it again?
I'd love to.
And I'd love to have him do it again. Holy cow, on a cracker. Was that good enough? It went a little long, this one, but I couldn't find a place to cut anything out because I thought his message was really amazing, actually. And it's so interesting to hear that field-level supervision, that really pointing into this stick supervision, talk about managing a highly reliable team. I just thought it was well worth our time to hear it all. I know we'll hear more from Mark again, and I'm really asking him to push down and maybe bring in some of the people he talked about and to talk a little bit about what they do and how they become highly reliable, how the new view looks and smells and tastes when you're actually using the new view every day. That's what it's all about. Thanks for listening. This was a long one, but I think a worthwhile one. I always welcome your feedback and input. That's good, and lots of you give it to me, and that's even better. Thanks for subscribing, because that's important, although I don't know why, and I can't figure out how to track it, but a lot of people ask me that question. And as always, you should have some fun every day, learn something new, and for goodness sakes, be safe.